Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Block Fuel Podcast. Today we are joined by Matthew Commons, who's the president of USDV Money, is a stablecoin, and not just any stablecoin. We'll dive through some of the differences. And I really want to start, though, if we could, Matthew, with your background. We talked last week, and you have quite the prolific background that brought you to USDV Money. So let's start there before we dive into how you guys are differentiating and all that fun jazz.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got business background, but my whole career has been in companies that are more engineering centric. Originally, that was clean tech, but 2013, 2014, started getting interested in Bitcoin, blockchain, and in 2015, founded a company called Cambridge Blockchain out of the MIT Media Lab. We were focused mainly on sharing identity data across groups of banks. Originally did some design work with banks like JP Morgan and Citi, but ultimately got more traction over in Europe because of the data privacy rules that were coming out. So an early version of what today might be considered self-sovereign identity. We were PayPal's first crypto investment, sold that business a little over 3 years ago. And since then have done a number of different activities with companies like Ledger, Algorand, and others. Came on board with the Verified USD Foundation in the fall for the soft launch that we had, which took place in November. And really excited to be here. And thanks for having me on.
No, we're excited to have you. So for those who are not familiar, everyone knows Circle, other stablecoins that are out there today. My first question, and not to throw you guys under the bus, but rather share with everyone what you guys are building. Why another stablecoin? And what do you guys do that maybe differentiates from some of the other stablecoins that are out there today?
Sure, absolutely. I'd say there are three things that are pretty different about USDV, which we consider the next gen stablecoin, versus the other big players that are out there. Number one is that it's much more accessible. Number two is that it's more transparent. And then number three is that it's much more decentralized. So what does that mean? So accessible, that a lot of that is coming through the fact that we are the first stablecoin to use Layer Zero's Omnichain Fungible Token Standard, or OFT. That means that every USDV wallet's born originally on Ethereum mainnet, it can be transferred without bridges to other chains. Today, we're on 7 chains: ETH mainnet, Arbitrum, Optimism, Avalanche, BNB, most recently Polygon and Vixen. But Layer Zero today connects to over 50 chains, with many more in the pipeline. That's really going to be one of the key differentiators. We want to be on more chains than any other stablecoin out there. The second is around transparency. So the verified and verified USD is about that. Our collateral is all on-chain. So it's not looking at an audit report that's coming out every month or something like that. Every USDV token is backed one for one by a special collateral token that represents a basket of short-term treasury bills and treasury repo arrangements. So that's something that is unique in the space, and we can talk a little bit more about. And then the final one, and I think this is perhaps the biggest, is that USDV is decentralized. With all the other big stablecoins, you're trusting one centralized for-profit entity to hold the collateral, and that entity gets all the yield from the underlying collateral. In this case, while USDV doesn't pay interest itself, can't if it's going to be broadly used and not a security, the minting that happens actually happens through our partners. So we've got partners on board such as Sushi, Pancake, Wintermute, BitGet, and a number of others across the CeFi, DeFi, and OTC space. And those minters that are bringing new participants into the ecosystem are able to share in the yield of the underlying collateral. And that's a big difference. We think it's more scalable. We think it's more decentralized. And we think that's really what is needed in the ecosystem today, especially that we're no longer in a world of zero interest rates. When interest rates were at zero, it didn't really matter. But that's something that is going to be critical for the growth and health of the ecosystem going forward.
Yeah, I think from that, a good segue is a lot of these product decisions and use cases that you're tackling and sharing yield, things that have been a product of what you've seen over the past year and a half, a quarterly statement from Tether or Circle, and you're like, wow, these guys with interest rates at 5% are making $1 billion on what they have in treasuries, and it's a pretty simple business model. Did some of that change during that process of, hey, there's concerns over balance sheets, but then those are solved and they're like, wait, like a stablecoin is actually a really good business. And then follow up question to that will be like, how do you see kind of interest rates changing if there is a cut in the next like couple quarters? Do you see that decreasing? Certainly like interest coming in, but then also does that change your business model?
Yeah. So I think it is a major issue. I think as interest rates have increased, it's provided an incentive that everybody wants to have their own stablecoin because everyone wants to capture that yield. You've seen that with BUSD. You've seen that with the Paxos coin. You've seen many others. And the challenge with that is that you end up with lots and lots of stablecoins. Everyone wants to say, hey, I have users. Why am I having the yield of that go to Tether and Circle and whoever? Why don't I create my own stablecoin and do that? And then you end up with this fragmented world, which is really equivalent to the US banking system before the Civil War, when banks would issue their own dollars, but you didn't know which one was really worth a dollar. There were actually specialized publications in New York that would say, okay, for a bank in the New Mexico territory, what is this going to be and what is that going to trade? And I think there's a risk that you end up in that with all these different stablecoins. The approach that we take is one where we're able to both provide fungibility, that every single USDB token is equal and exchangeable to others, but we can also at the same time track who is the minter that brought that capital into the system. And that's through the color trace mechanism that was developed by Layer Zero, and we're the exclusive licensee of that for a two-year period. So that's really the underlying technological innovation that means you don't have to choose between fungibility and getting the yield to support your ecosystem. You can really have both at the same time.
How do you guys reach that mass scale and like the mass adoption? Because stablecoins, they definitely have made some waves amongst people that are in the space, right? If I go talk to 10 people on the street, though, maybe one has used them in the past, right? So how do we reach that kind of level where it's all over, whether it's maybe accepted by retailers or is this going to be mostly used for between banks, like interoperability there? Can you just dive into a little bit more of your mindset around that?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. First of all, it's a marathon, not a sprint, right? The existing incumbent players have been there for many years and have taken time to build this up. And it's just not the case that you can show up with, even if you've got great partners and great technology, it's still new. It takes time for people to learn and recognize and trust that. So we recognize that. And the way that we're starting right now is really focused on CeFi and DeFi. It's focused on the crypto native communities that know Layer Zero, that know Matrixport or other partner, and are comfortable with that. So you see that in terms of the relationships with BitGet, Curve, Sushi, Wombat, Velodrome, Maverick, others in the space, Frax as well. That's where we're starting, CeFi and DeFi. But as we look at the future growth, one of the things that's really interesting to us and that we're spending a lot of time exploring and building partnerships is in emerging markets, and especially in economies where there's high inflation and maybe not safe and robust and cheap access to dollars. I was just in Argentina a few weeks ago, and it's amazing with their new president on board, a true libertarian, but also in a society that has a lot of issues and has faced profound challenges and has a real lack of trust in the conventional banking sector and the government. This is where people keep stacks of $100 bills under the couch and use $100 bills to buy houses. 10% of the US physical currency that's ever printed is in Argentina. And that's just because the conventional rails don't exist there. So that's interesting. And that's just one example. I think there's other high inflation economies. There's other underbanked economies, as I mentioned, doing work with Viction, the former Tomo chain in Vietnam, where it's a young, growing, dynamic, crypto-friendly population that is underbanked. And when we can work with partners there, that's really where we see a lot of the growth in sort of real-world use cases. We're going to see that in the United States as well, but it's not like everybody is walking around in Vietnam or Argentina with a Zelle and type system or something like that in their pocket that you have in the US. So I think that provides some of the most attractive opportunities outside of the more crypto native space.
How did you guys, I guess, land on both Viction and Vietnam as a country as well? There's certainly other countries around the world. And I have heard that adoption in Vietnam is actually penetration is like 50% or 40%, something like crazy high. Still would love to hear like how that journey, who'd you start speaking with? Did you identify it or they come to you?
Yeah, it's something where those just happen to be the ones that have come out of the gates fastest. I'd say that there are many more. Again, if you look at the 50 chains that Layer Zero connects to, that'll probably give you a good idea of our roadmap. And when we look at the rollout, it's not so much based on the technical capabilities. It's very easy for us to connect to a marginal chain. The reason we're on 7 chains today and not on 50 chains today isn't for a technical reason. It's really just, you want to have critical mass, if nothing else, around marketing and messaging and liquidity of underlying pools and things like that to do that. And that was able to happen in Vietnam for some other markets. Our partner Matrixport is based in Singapore. They had a relationship with a company Coin98, which is quite active in Vietnam. And they were super eager to get out of the gates with us. And that's the reason why they ended up there as our 7th chain.
How did you guys get out the gates initially? Do you guys have like major backers to start this off, or is this, I don't know, I can't imagine bootstrapping a massive undertaking like this. So if you could walk us through who's helping behind the scenes here and share a little bit there.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is all public. From a technology level, the technology that we're using is licensed from Layer Zero. So there's two specific pieces. One is the Omnichain Fungible Token Standard. Again, that's publicly available, and that's what sort of allows us to natively mint on so many different chains. And then the other is the color trace algorithm, which is what allows us to efficiently track which of our partners or verified minters is what we call them. Are bringing new users and new capital into the system, and track it in a way that we can color the coins, but still have the coins be totally fungible. So Layer Zero is very important on the technology side. Matrixport is very important on the operation side. They're one of the major crypto financial service players in Asia, but in other markets as well. A lot of the team members were formerly with Bitmain, and they're the ones that, through an affiliate called Matrix Stock, provide the structure for our underlying collateral token of short-term treasury bills. So they're very involved in that as well. And I think it's a great collaboration across the two of them. And then, of course, there's a list of 30-some partners right now that we have on the DeFi, CeFi, and OTC space.
And
Man,
just, I guess I was gonna say, yeah, for say people not familiar with the flow of stable coins currently, like, and this is probably a very oversimplification, but with something like Circle, you would say if you're in the US, you would go in and you'd, if you can create a Circle account, I know they're trying to move away from like individuals and more towards businesses, but in the past, you could wire in money, say you wire in $100, and then that goes from a US bank into Circle's US bank, and they have banking partners. That $100 is then Circle takes that and gives you $100 in USDC coins. And then they take that $100 and then they go buy treasuries and buy different assets that are stable and pegged to the dollar. So, in just playing this back to you, is you're moving away from being reliant on the US banking system. You're taking that $100, or instead of you personally taking that $100, your partner, say Wintermute or another London-based partner that provides liquidity, is taking the $100, minting it. And then what happens there? What, in the very basic sense, what are the
So ultimately, that $100 ends up with the US Treasury, right? It ends up in short-term Treasury securities or Treasury repos. So the way that happens, that flow could be through another stablecoin. It could be through a USDT or USDC or whatever that is then converted into something out and cashed into fiat and bought treasuries, or it could happen through other mechanisms depending on how that works. But generally, if you look big picture, if USDB is growing, there's more money in the US Treasury's coffers. And it's really more of what are the mechanics around that for someone handing over cash in Vietnam at a small shop, or an institutional player making a $5 million wire. That's going to be a little bit different, exactly how the mechanics work, but ultimately you're ending up with US dollars purchasing US Treasury securities, and that's what stands behind the USDB.
can you talk a little bit more globally? You were touching on Argentina earlier. Obviously, El Salvador has been in the news quite a bit too with their major turnaround. So LATAM seems to be making some noise. Like last year, it felt like Asia was in the headlines. Now, more recently with LATAM, US has big news. I think it was today or yesterday now.
Yeah, absolutely.
With the ETFs coming and being approved, they had that little hiccup where someone either hacked the system or they went too early with their tweet yesterday. But do you see the U.S. this kind of expediting some of the processes here in the U.S. with the ETF, or do you think it's still going to be a lot of red tape moving forward?
Yeah, the U.S. is it's the biggest market in the world, and as a U.S. dollar stablecoin backed by U.S. Treasuries, obviously we're paying a lot of attention to that. I think we'll see what happens with any type of stablecoin bill in the U.S. Congress. We'll see what happens. We've got elections coming up this year, so we'll see. We made the strategic decision right now that in order to be a minter, you have to be non-U.S. and you have to have at least $5 million in assets. That was just the cleanest way for us to get started. U.S. is a critically important market, and one day would we love to be at a place where you can send wires in directly from your bank account and get USDV directly back? Absolutely. But there's a whole regulatory process to go around that, and there's been quite a bit of ambiguity around that. Right now, we don't allow U.S.-based minting, just where we are in our growth map now, but it's something we're following very closely. Representative McHenry, Representative Waters, they do have some really interesting things that are there. But there's other interesting stablecoin regulations elsewhere in the world as well. The UAE having a stablecoin framework, Singapore, where Matrixport is based. So we're benchmarking ourselves against all of those. I think while it's pretty early days still for what exactly is going to qualify as like an official stablecoin in various jurisdictions, it's definitely something that we're paying a lot of attention to and benchmarking internally to make sure that as these regulations evolve over the world, we're going to be in a good position to make sure that USDV is as widely accepted as possible.
So just touching on that a little bit further, like I feel like people initially come in for the yield. Now, once it hits retailers, will we be able to buy Tesla had used to be able to use Bitcoin, for example? So do you see a world in which retailers will be using USDV? And if so, like how far off would we be from that? And is that something you guys would need to then partner with an intermediary, maybe it'd be like Visa or another kind of payment processor to just be a partner in that sense? Or are you guys going to have your one-to-one connection in there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's really a question of sort of sequencing. What makes sense to roll out at what point? And I think if you look at the different types of stablecoins, they have different strengths in these areas. I think Circle is clearly the leader in connecting into the U.S. financial system. As you said, sending a bank wire, which if you have a business account, you can do and out. And one of the things that that has resulted in is probably a little bit less volatility, excusing the Silicon Valley Bank scenario that happened last year. In terms of a day-to-day thing, it is more redeemable than other stablecoins, and that's been a real strength of theirs. And we want the USDV to be redeemable as well. We're focused on specific use cases. And right now, there's a whole roadmap of different types of use cases out there in inflation economies. It could be dollarizing merchant payments. It could be something that is focused more on remittance. It could be something focused more on the freelance sector. And to start, we will anticipate using intermediaries, and we anticipate to continue using those. We're not looking to supplant Visa or anything like that. But I think you've seen things where in a number of different economies around the world, there's things where you can have crypto, broadly speaking, and have a Visa card that connects to that. And you have that in the U.S., you have that in other countries around the world. But then there's other geographies where maybe not everyone is walking around with Visa cards in their pocket and they're looking to leapfrog those conventional rails. And that may very well end up with a different type of flow than you have elsewhere. But no matter what, making sure that we are compliant from a regulatory perspective, every minter that we deal with goes through a very robust KYC AML check, including on-chain verification, Refinitiv world check background, all types of things. Making sure that whatever we do around the world, that we're doing it in the right way is important to us.
On the side of like the identity side, and you mentioned around like KYC and your partners, just from your experience and like doing like self-sovereign identity, like where do you see just the consumer side moving, say with ETFs getting approved? It's not there's going to be a lack of regulation coming in that everything's green light as it is today. But we've heard from partners that there's going to be a big KYC push. Like, what would be your take on like where you think see things going for consumers, both in the US and internationally?
Yeah, I think a lot of that starts with the regulated endpoint. In almost every country, virtual asset service providers, if you're providing the interface between fiat and crypto, that is a regulated activity. And in many cases, a lot of our minters are the ASPs. They're regulated. And they're the ones that are interfacing with the public, that are doing the KYC checks and onboarding. And we want to make sure that they're doing that in the right way. So we're enabling others to then, you know, become minters and deal with that. And depending on where they're located, they're going to have different types of regulatory requirements. Are they in New York? Do they have a BIT license? Do they do this? So they're on the front ends with that. And we provide the framework that allows them to participate in USDB from a minting perspective. But yeah, different geographies and different types of businesses will have that. But ultimately, I think when you see like things like the Financial Action Task Force, there's going to be increasing levels of harmonization in this space around this. And I think the right way to do it is to really have the endpoints be the ones that are regulated, keep the underlying crypto rails as open as possible, with, of course, the understanding that, look, if there's some big hack and the Lazarus group has a bunch of funds someplace, those assets may need to be frozen or something like that. And we have an obligation to work with regulators, as do all the other stablecoin issuers as well, around that. Those are definitely things that we've built into our plan from day one.
Mm-hmm. Coming off this news with the ETFs and Bitcoin, any like major predictions, or do we expect like an Ethereum ETF to come anytime soon? Just from a very high level, if you would have any kind of takes on, I'm just always curious to see if this is like a one-off thing, and then nothing's going to happen until the election clears out.
Yeah, I just have to say, I don't understand really the underlying rationale. I don't think it's necessarily the reason why a Bitcoin ETF is approved, but an Ethereum one isn't approved yet. I think it's been a little bit frustrating in the US. You've seen a lot of regulation by enforcement, a lack of clear guidance, as much as there is a, hey, come in and register soundbite and talking point. Practically speaking, that's not something that, I think you read the filings from Coinbase and others, there's not a clear path. Like there is in other countries with Mika in the EU or other places like that. Where we go from here, I think this is a watershed moment. I think having a Bitcoin ETF really means this is the first time that conventional financial advisors, without doing anything in terms of private keys or dealing with specific crypto exchanges or whatever, now have the ability to include crypto in a conventional portfolio. Without some of the trade-offs, I know there were these futures-based ETFs before, but they have slippage issues, they have fees issues, they have other things. So this is a watershed moment. I think we will see more, but I'm probably not the right one to take guidance from on exactly what happens then. We are in an election year, so I think you'll see more whatever way things go. I think that'll certainly have an impact, but it's super exciting to see. Again, I can't say tomorrow that there's going to be such huge inflows, but as the whole conventional financial space thinks about Bitcoin as an asset class that can be added in, I think you see a lot that happened with gold, with the gold ETF. And that was since time immemorial, people have been saving gold, and you had in time, a significant difference there. It'll definitely have a major impact on, you know, on the digital asset space broadly.
I guess speaking of elections specifically, you mentioned Argentina, Milei was elected. And the question I have for you, you see a lot of what's going on, is where do you see beyond El Salvador buying Bitcoin? And that's part of their initial strategy. They rolled out the Chivo wallet that was created for individuals to exchange Bitcoin. What do you see a country like Argentina realistically implementing with, say, a digital asset push? Or Milei's mentioned,
I mean,
you know, using
it
US dollar
move. Yeah, it is going down there. I think the most popular one is Tether on Tron. And you can go to these little, it's like these like cuevas, they're like caves. And they're these sort of unlicensed, informal money changers. And you go in there and you can buy and sell USDT. And part of it is also there's multiple different exchange rates. There's been a lot of capital controls there. So you have maybe 40 different rates. There's the blue dollar rate, and there's the official rate, which is sometimes differed substantially, although there with Milei, he's reducing that. There's rates where you buy bonds in pesos and then sell them in dollars. These things add so much friction to the system. So I think it's great that they're clearing out a lot of those headaches and inefficiencies and layers upon layers of taxation and so forth that have existed there. But it exists today. And I think that's why some of these emerging markets are quite interesting, because you're not saying, okay, so tell me about your stablecoin. You've got to, how does that compare against Zelle or Venmo? You're not competing against Zelle or Venmo in these types of markets. It's a fundamentally different opportunity. And we're learning and we'll see. What I like about USDV, and this is from my personal career perspective, is we're not picking one chain. There's so much cool technology out here. And as much as I love to dig into it, I don't want to be picking like, oh, like it's going to be an Avalanche subnet for this, and it's going to be Tron for that, and Vixen for that. Like, it's too much to even follow at a somewhat high level, much less like put all your chips on one. So the fact that USDV can be across all these different chains, many different markets, we provide this framework where we can see what grows, double down on the bets that are showing a lot of momentum. That's what really excites me about USDV. And I think, as again, a marathon, not a sprint, in the long term, we expect that this will, you know, help us as we seek to outpace some of the others in the space.
Last question here, and then we can wrap up. Talking more about this global kind of globalization, if you will, how closely do you have to work with these various governments, if at all? Because you mentioned, you know, Vietnam, Argentina a few times now. Are you guys working with their regulators constantly, or can you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We follow the regulatory guidelines in all the different jurisdictions where we operate. Some of them are less clear than others. So when we look at European markets, for example, they have a pretty structured framework. They've got MiCA. When we look at Singapore, again, they don't have their stablecoin guidance finalized yet, but like it's pretty clear the types of things that we're going to be looking for, and whether it's us directly or our partners, they're working very closely there. In other areas, and I would include the US in this category, there's not a lot of crypto-specific regulation. You're going back to the Securities Act of 1934 or whatever, and you're interpreting that, and you have to deal with that. So we need to know what those are. Argentina is a little more in that type of camp where there's not as much crypto-specific regulation as there are in other markets, and you're in a position of trying to figure out how are regulators likely to interpret laws written decades ago in this context. You have to talk to the regulators, you have to deal with the appropriate legal counsel in the space and try to chart a path forward. But that's where we are today. And that's also some of what makes this space so exciting. But we've been really clear. We're a verified USD foundation, came and domiciled, and have some, the smart contract itself is governed with the BVI regulator. Close contacts there, very clear guidance around KYC, AML, financial crime reporting, and so forth. And that's critical. So anywhere in the world, if there's an issue with this, they know how to get in touch with the BVI regulator, work with us, and make sure that we're doing things appropriately. But we always want those to be really narrowly tailored and appropriate for the situation and have a valid legal basis for any of that.
So you guys did a soft launch, I believe, in November. It's this upcoming November.
That's right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Last November. Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. And then you guys will be at ETH Denver, we were just talking about before we hit record. So folks that are listening can come meet you and some of the other folks from your team at ETH Denver. And I guess, what are the next like 3 to 6 months look like for you guys?
Yeah, I would definitely say more chains. Again, look at that list of 50 layer zero chains and so forth. And it's going to be additional ones there. And yeah, growing, I would say, from the CeFi and DeFi. Right now, it's heavily focused a little bit more on kind of the swapping type pools. I'd say a push more into borrowing and lending pools over the near term. And then over more of the medium term, deployments in the real world, especially in some of these emerging markets. So I'm super excited about that because, yeah, like growing country, young country, doesn't have the conventional banking system. So to be able to be part of that story and providing real value to people in their daily lives is definitely something that I'm super excited about.
That's awesome. Thanks so much for coming on, Matthew. Yeah. I really appreciate your time. And I think people will enjoy this on the Blockfield podcast. I appreciate it.
Excellent. Thanks so much. And yeah, look forward to connecting at ETH Denver next month.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll do. Thanks, Matthew.